Thanks, Steve. They do let me out of the studio on occasion. And this is one of those times, and it's fun because I get to talk to people for a change as opposed to a wall and just pretending like you exist somewhere out in Michigan. There are people listening. I know you're there. So thanks for being here. Thanks for joining us. This is a very fluid conversation. And so we hope that as you have questions that you'll just pop your hand up. It's not one of those things where you have to wait. Is it time yet to ask my question? Is it time? Just ask your question when you're ready. We'll bring a mic to you. So I want to introduce our panelists who were wonderful enough to join us tonight. Starting from your right, my left, we have Jamie Bennett. She's a training specialist and the Center for Fostering Success at Western Michigan University. Next to her is John Bebo. He is president and CEO of the Center for Michigan. And John has been doing, well, Bridge Magazine's been doing some incredible reporting on college affordability. And then to my left is Adam Eichmeier, who is a graduate student at U of M studying public health. He's also a first-generation student from Wallace, Michigan. So way, way, way up north, way up north. So I want to start the conversation with you, John. When I got here, you were talking about your college experience. And I think that's a very interesting place to start. Talk about what happened for you when you decided to go to college.
First of all, I'm a Bronco. Any Broncos here? Let's go. Ready? Run. One, two, three. Western, we sing to you. What? Anyway, go Broncos. I went here a long time ago, obviously. But I was telling Jen, I spent a lot of my undergrad time right across the road here at Millen Park Golf Course. No joke. There was a time when college students had enough disposable income that when they should have been studying, they actually went to places like Millen Park Golf Course. I'm not a rich kid. I grew up in the hog farm in town in Mason, Michigan. My dad was a window salesman. I'm like this young man here, first-generation college student. But I worked in the dorms. I was a resident advisor. I'm supposed to call them residence halls, aren't I? I'm sorry. I won't let that happen again. And I had a little money in my pocket. My wife is an adjunct professor at Eastern Michigan University now, and I watch what her students go through, and it is an entirely different experience than I had. It is shocking the number of jobs and the way students are scraping to pay for their opportunities today.
And you were able to go based on working during school, and your father was able to pick up the tuition.
Yeah, at the time, and we weren't rich, but my dad told me from the age of 10 up, kid, you're going to college. Get good grades. And they saved their pennies and pop cans and everything else to help me. And at the time, I didn't know this at the time, but I've since done research on this. My dad got a great deal. The state of Michigan was paying 2/3 of the cost of my education through state appropriations. Those ratios have been reversed today and are sliding in completely the opposite direction. My dad is very glad to know he got that good deal, and he feels very bad for the rest of you.
Now, Adam, contrast that experience with your experience starting in college.
Yeah, so I haven't golfed at all during college, but that's probably more to my lack of skill or love for golf. But yeah, going to U of M, I really didn't understand what paying for college really meant. I remember getting my financial aid awards in the summer before, or maybe it was the spring before I would have started school. And I remember that U of M, where I actually at the time didn't want to go, was giving me a lot more money than Michigan State, which was actually where I was going to go until I got recruited away by Michigan. Eventually, you know, I went to Michigan and quickly realized that it was going to be really hard to afford going to school there. So I don't know how, I guess my parents really instilled a lot of piss and vinegar in me, but I emailed the financial aid office and I said, hi, this really isn't working. What can you do to keep me here? And they said, well, we'll give you an extra $5,000 a year scholarship. And that's really what I needed to get through the rest of my time. And I also worked in a similar role as a resident advisor, more on the academic advising side of things, so that my housing costs would be covered for. And then I picked up a job at the hospital doing office work at first and then moving into research work so that I could have a little bit of money to spend on the side. Because for anyone that knows the student population at Michigan, most of them are used to spending a lot of their money very frivolously. So if you want to fit in with those students and have any sort of social life, you kind of have to find some of that money to be able to do those kind of things with them. Otherwise, you end up sitting on your couch in your dorm or your residence hall room by yourself a lot of the time. So I worked a lot of my way through college, had a lot of great financial aid from U of M, and then my parents helped out where they could. But I didn't have a college savings plan or anything like that. We just kind of hit college with our feet on the ground and did the best we could, and I made it through. Actually, I graduated debt-free from U of M from working.
Wow.
Yeah.
I did not.
It's hard to do, but I really learned to appreciate money and to save a lot of my money, and now I'll actually graduate debt-free from my graduate program because I've been teaching my way through it. So I feel like I have to say that I'm really an anomaly when it comes to first-gen students at the University of Michigan, and I've been really fortunate in my experience in that sense.
Mm-hmm. And just in case we weren't clear, first-gen, these are students who are the first in their family to attend college. You know, Jamie, do these stories sound familiar to you? And I'm thinking more Adam's experience, in that you have students who start college and aren't necessarily aware of the financial burden they're taking on.
Yeah, absolutely. So I can speak both from professional and personal experience in this area. I myself was a first-generation college student, and the students that I work with at the Center for Fostering Success have experienced foster care. And so they're often when you are aging out of foster care, you also are first-generation in your family. So my personal experience was also at Michigan State, not to rag on them, but back in my freshman year when I was there, I was asked to stand up in a lecture course and told that I had a bill. I thought everything was paid for, and sent to the financial aid office, and they pushed some paperwork my way, and I took out my first student loan, which I actually didn't know was happening at the time. So that kind of just not knowing and being told what to do without all of the information was an experience I had quite some time ago. So I think my work with students at Western within the Center for Fostering Success is really about making sure that they're at the table and aware of what it is that they have available to them to make college affordable and how to engage in ways that Adam just talked about and calling and advocating with places like the financial aid office to make that possible versus just shoving paperwork and asking them to sign it without having a lot of information.
Mm-hmm. And John, it's interesting because when we think about popular narratives in this state, and I would say nationally as well, there's this story we tell, which is you go to high school, you do your post-high school open house, everybody comes and celebrates, you go to college, you get a job. And that narrative doesn't really fit the reality of what's happening now, because it doesn't include the debt load you may take out of college with you. It doesn't say that, well, the job you get may not be enough to pay off that debt. What's shifted in this story that's creating an issue when it comes to access to college?
I think that narrative is shifting based on what we heard from the public in the last year. Part of what the Center for Michigan does is we travel the state and we hold community meetings, 25 people at a time, every corner of the state. And we ask people about topics that are relevant in Lansing right now, and we create reports like the one that are on your table. We don't come into this with an axe to grind, but we're trying to amplify whatever the public's voice is in the halls of power. And we spent the last year talking about college affordability issues as one of the key topics. And I think the narrative is changing. We were very surprised. I was very surprised. I'm always very surprised by what we hear, but in this particular case, more than half the people that took part, not only in our community meetings, but we backed those up with then phone polls and online surveys, and we really pay attention to areas where we see agreement across all of our survey methods. And this is one of those areas of agreement. There's a public questioning now about the value of going to college. We call it a conundrum, because there's wide public acceptance of the need for some kind of training after high school. Could be vocational training or certification in a trade or college. But there's questioning about the true value of getting a degree at the end because of the massive increase in costs over the past generation or so. There's really a return on investment calculation that we think is going on at the kitchen table level about, is this really worth it?
When you were making the decision about school, were you having those conversations with either, you know, counselors at school or with your family? Did you know what you were getting into, I guess is my question.
No. I didn't know what I was getting into. I still don't know if I know what I'm getting into. But, you know, those conversations didn't really happen in Menominee, Michigan, where I went to high school. A lot of people didn't go to college, and the ones that did kind of went with the expectation that we'd finally be able to work ourselves out of this city and never come back, which is sad, but is really true. That was kind of the way to leave that perpetual cycle. So, I remember we talked about college, you know, as a way to do something that you're actually interested in instead of staying in a job that you hate because it's what is available. But, you know, there were no return on investment calculations being done at my kitchen table, at least. It was just kind of a thing that if you want to do this, you should do it.
How do you have this conversation with the young people you work with, especially if they're coming from a situation where they may not have that familial support? They don't have the family members or friends they can fall back on if they need an additional financial boost?
Yeah, we start the conversation quite early because it's important for the students to be fully aware of what they're committing to, as well as all of the other pieces that go along with that. So how much are you going to make in your chosen career? Is it going to be worth the amount that you're spending? What are your plans? Are you going to go to grad school? All of those things. In addition to financial skills that can help support some of the decisions made in college. So how do you budget appropriately? How do you stay aware of how much you're taking out in loans and what that's going to cost you after graduation? So there's a lot of pieces to the puzzle. And I will say in the work that I do directly with students, that conversation often starts in the first time that I speak with them, very early, before they even arrive on campus for freshman year during those orientation phases.
You know, John, I think the question I always come back to is, how did we end up here, where tuition at a public institution in the state isn't affordable for many students? I remember when I was at U of M, I worked probably 30 hours a week. I was a resident advisor. I carried 18 credits. And having that kind of responsibility, you're not able to take advantage of the unpaid internships. It's not an option. You got to work. So it changes the overall college experience for some students, but it wasn't always this way. So how did we get to this place?
Through several avenues. and I think we could debate much longer than tonight who's to blame or what is to blame. And I think there's a lot of good arguments to be made on several levels. But there's several forces converging on today's college students, continually tightening the vise. One is the state investment. I talked about my dad getting a great deal. That has changed since the 80s and 90s. The state, during the budget crunches of recent years, disinvested in universities. The state has an agency of bean counters. They're called the House and Senate Fiscal Agency. They're accountants and policy experts. They're nonpartisan, regardless of who's in control. These are the truth tellers in the legislature. They've calculated that the decrease in state investment in universities is responsible for about 60% of the tuition increases since the turn of the century. That still leaves the other 40%. Tuition has gone up tremendously. I can rattle off numbers to you all night. I don't want you to fall asleep. But one of the other factors is, as tuition has gone up, household income has actually decreased in Michigan. So you've got just tightening of vices here. As a result, the release valve that students are increasingly using is the release valve of student loans. At the turn of the century, there's 15 public universities in Michigan. At the turn of the century, the collective student bodies of those universities in 1 year took out $800 million in student loans. That sounds like a lot of money. Today, it is $2 billion. $2 billion a year in student loans that students are taking out at just our 15 public universities. I'm not counting community colleges. I'm not counting private universities. $2 billion. That's the release valve that students are using now to continue to pay for the kind of opportunity that you're trying to get. And I fear that we're reaching a bubble in this system. I don't know that this is sustainable at all.
And what does it mean when you're talking about $2 billion and loans being taken out, but all of that money doesn't necessarily get paid back. So what does that mean for the state?
Nor does it always necessarily result in a degree. A lot of students are not getting all the way through school within 6 years, and the pressure points, again, come into play here. Students have to work more. Students are taking longer to get through their degree programs because they're working more to help pay for them. So the system has a series of inefficiencies to it that there's still tons of opportunity out there, and you can do it. You can work in the residence halls. I got it right. You can work in the cafeteria, you can work your tail off, and you can still have the American dream, but the path is a lot steeper than it ever used to be.
And again, I just want to invite you, if you have a question, there's a question back there, Brittany. You know, Jamie, when you're talking to your student, how much concern do you have about the type of experience they're going to be able to have if they have these additional concerns and aren't able to perhaps take advantage of certain opportunities, like, for instance, unpaid internships, because they have this financial concern? How do you manage that with them?
We're actually very fortunate, and I can give a shout out to Western here. So the Center for Fostering Success includes the CETA Scholars Program, and that program is the direct service component for all of the students that attend. So we have 150 students in our program, and they all receive full tuition scholarships that are part of the base funded budget for Western Michigan University. So we actually get to have really great conversations, like, how do you save your money because you have a little bit extra left over? How do you plan for graduation? How do we leverage resources that are available to you so you don't have to have a mound of student debt when you graduate? So the conversation is actually fun. Now, at Western, we get that advantage, and that advantage is not available at all schools, and we're aware of that. Another initiative in the center that I work in is Fostering Success Michigan, and they do outreach to folks doing work at schools, universities, that don't have that advantage, that don't have a full tuition scholarship. And, you know, the road is steeper. It very much is that way. And there's the conversation is just real, you know, that it might take longer. You may have more student debt. How do we prepare you for that? How do we start early so that you can plan for it?
Yes.
Hi, I'm also a grad student. Actually, I just got my degree in the mail a couple weeks ago. I've got my PhD now, so. And might not want to clap for me because I'm slightly underemployed right now. I'm looking, but I'm also wondering, my question is about the whole attitude of, you know, you can do it, you can have the American dream. And I'm wondering if we don't spend enough time encouraging alternatives to higher education, and if we are able to offer more alternatives. In this case, you know, we've got this climate right now that's, you know, that you've talked about, that's sort of a darkening of the sky, so to speak. And I'm wondering why there aren't more attitudes that are sort of encouraging alternate pathways.
John, I'm going to throw that your way.
Great, great point. Bridge Magazine, which the Center for Michigan publishes, did a story in summer 2014 about the fact that there are 70,000 open jobs in Michigan, or there was at that moment. A lot of them are in the skilled trades, which have gotten kind of a bad name. We need tons of plumbers and electricians and skilled tradespeople in Michigan. Culture kind of lags. We've kind of, as a society, bought into what my dad believed, which is, son, just go to college, it'll all work out. And I think when I went, I think that was largely true. It's very different today. So you just go out on the highway, drive down 94, and you'll probably see billboards for 6 or 8 universities by the time you get to Jackson. And every one of those billboards, promises hope, opportunity, freedom, and the American dream. And I think they mean it, but I think some of that falls empty for some students. I think universities are in a bit of an arms race today for students. Universities are trying to be all things to all people. Universities offer an incredible amount of degree programs, which both speaks to opportunity and, I think, to inefficiency. Who's heard of the banned words list at Lake State University? Anybody heard of that? For 40 years, they've put out a list at Lake State, the banished words, the words we should get rid of in the English language. It's a great marketing device. They get national media for it every year. You would think you'd need some pretty talented linguists to produce such a document every year. Lake State graduated, they conferred 3 degrees in English in 2014. 3. Not 300. 3. Why do they have a degree program in English? We have dozens of programs like that at our Michigan universities. There's not a sense of centers of excellence where maybe you're going to Northern and you want to be one of the 18 who graduated last year in history. Well, there's a great history program at Central. There's a great history program at Michigan State or U of M. There's inefficiencies in the system. And I think part of that's due to the arms race that universities are in. I think we need a lot more people like Jamie who are helping students discern what they want to do earlier. The game has completely changed. I have the pleasure of knowing a businessman. He took part in a conference we did on career navigation yesterday in Livonia. His name is Jim Danielski. He runs a company in Plymouth, Michigan called Career Planning Specialists. I'm not here to advertise for him, but I think his story is fascinating. His business feasts on students graduating and then not being able to get employed because they've never developed a real life plan of what they want to do. A lot of people are still believing in the Holy Grail like my father did. Just go to college, it'll all work out. It's not working out for a lot of people, and we don't have a system or a cultural process or procedure or belief that you got to plan, and you got to plan earlier, and if you don't plan, there's going to be huge costs down the road. That's really tough. We've all been 18. We've all been 21. To ask people to be totally different than the generation before them and plan in whole new ways is a huge cultural shift. Yeah. But those who do it and get it right, they really do have that promise and that opportunity.
You know, Adam, I'm curious, when you were making the decision about what your post-high school plans would be, did you have those conversations about, you know, maybe college isn't the road, maybe it's something else? Or was it really that sort of go to college, get your education, you'll be fine?
Yeah, I guess for me it's a little different because I had always wanted to be a surgeon. So really the only way to get to where I wanted to go was to go to college. Right, was to go to college and then go to medical school. But definitely once I got into college, my plan shifted within the first few weeks of being there, and I went down a different trajectory, completely different trajectory, with the same end goal but a completely different way of getting there.
I'm curious, Jamie, when I hear these conversations about the alternatives to college, I want to be careful about how I phrase this because I wonder who do we want to be in those jobs? Are we creating a situation where the alternatives are for certain people, but college is still reserved for certain people? And that's what I get concerned about, because when I hear about discussions about these are honorable professions. But could we set up a system where higher education is reserved for the people who can afford it?
I think we might be doing that already. I think, do I have an answer for that? I don't know. So I think it's a tough question. But are we reserving, who do we want in those jobs? And I think the question is, rather than asking ourselves who we want in those jobs, is to ask people, do you want to be in those jobs? And then helping them get there. You know, so I work with students at Western. It's a 4-year university. And I often will talk with students that are there because somebody else thinks they should be there because we have a great scholarship program. And I'll tell them right away that what other people want for you is probably not going to make you feel great, you know, long term. And so what do you want for yourself? And if someone decides to leave the university because they want to chase, you know, a career in welding, or they want to be an art student in art school, or they want to go into pharmaceuticals, or, you know, things like that, and Western doesn't offer that, I support that wholeheartedly. Because I think if you're going to spend the money and the time and the energy, then you should do something that you love. And that's worthwhile for you. Because probably, I mean, if you don't, you're probably going to just stop and go back and do that eventually anyway for more money, you know, down the road.
Yeah. You know, when I think about how the state has shaped its early childhood education platform at this point, it was really like, okay, we're not going to have a workforce in 20 years. We've got to figure out a way to start preparing kids from a very early age to be employable, and that starts with a high-quality early education. John, are we at a place where we're starting to have those conversations around higher ed as well?
I think the public is.
But at a policy level?
I don't know. I don't think the policymakers really are in a serious way yet. And I'm not fully convinced that the universities are. And, I mean, I hold personally higher ed as holy, absolutely holy, but I'm also tough on it. And I'm not convinced, and part of what's driving my thought is what we heard from the public. 9 out of 10 people who we surveyed said universities need to become more efficient. That's easy to say, and I think universities have done a lot of things to become more efficient, but I'm not convinced they've done enough. Not when we see tuition continuing to rise the way it has, not when we have dozens of degree programs that are not really graduating people, and not when we have a $2 billion a year student loan takeout rate in this state. I worry that we're reaching a point where universities may be pricing themselves out of a market, and alternatives are going to crop up that are going to provide students with alternative means of getting to the careers they want.
But I wonder if some of it is... You know, we're part of, as a part of the University of Michigan, we're part of the research corridor, and there's a lot of focus on research, and it's important research, but it's also about making themselves valuable to the state beyond just educating students, which is their primary responsibility.
One of the answers that I hear a lot from people in universities is that's well and good, but the state has disinvested to the point to where the state is in danger of becoming irrelevant in university budgets. I mean, it's a very small proportion of the budgets now for a lot of universities, and universities are constantly raising money, endowing this and endowing that for university priorities. University of Michigan gets a sliver of its budget from state appropriations, and yet state legislators want to tell the university to do this or do that. Well, really? Based on what? Where's the leverage there?
But it hasn't changed the dynamic. Like I hear what you're saying, and it makes logical sense, but the dynamic is still the same. So I don't know how that dynamic shifts, because the state has disinvestment. We felt the disinvestment as the state's pulled out funding. I mean, it's...
I think that's where we're going to see some changing models. You're seeing a lot more online... technology in play in a lot of degree programs. Atlantic Monthly did a whole issue a year ago on is the university dead? Because there are startups starting up, and I'm not talking just the for-profit loan factories that are now getting caught and going out of business, but other ways of training people for specific professions. Some of our universities are working on models that are very old. Eastern Michigan and Western Michigan, they started out as teaching colleges in large part. We produce far more teaching graduates every year than we could possibly employ in Michigan. We are teaching mills for Arizona, North Carolina, and other states. What's the point of that if you're a Michigan taxpayer? I think the models are really going to start to change. Grand Valley is an example of a model that has changed completely. It was this little state university out in a cornfield in Allendale. They said, we got to grow. They put themselves back downtown at a time when Grand Rapids was starting to boom downtown. Grand Valley has also boomed downtown. Part of the way they've marketed themselves to parents is by being customer friendly, and they're not afraid to call their students customers. I can start a huge fight in this room by doing that, and I don't mean to. But they're not afraid to call their students customers. They've developed an annual accountability report. They're tracking the annual licensure rates of their accounting graduates, their nursing graduates, their psychology graduates, and they're reporting that back to potential students, selling themselves as customer-oriented. I think those are the kinds of changes, and they're winning. Their enrollments are through the roof, and it is not even close to the place it was when I was an undergrad. Grand Rapids was dead. Nobody went to Grand Rapids. It wasn't cool. And Grand Valley was, what's Grand Valley?
You know, I want to talk a little bit about the accessibility piece, because you can get to school and not feel like it's a place for you. And Adam, what was your experience like as a first-gen student coming into the University of Michigan?
Yeah, the first year was hard. It was almost horrible, actually. I came in. My advisor thought that I was this very smart student because I was valedictorian of my class and that I could take the hardest course load ever for my first semester of freshman year in the honors program. And about 2 weeks in, I realized that I couldn't do it and that something needed to change, otherwise I wasn't going to make it. So this is when I completely changed my path. And college was about 2 or maybe 3 weeks into the semester. I decided I can't do a basic science degree. I didn't get the preparation in high school, and I need to do something else. So I switched things around, and I moved forward. And I remember I went home at Thanksgiving break, and I had lunch with my high school chemistry teacher, who was my mentor all throughout high school and helped me eventually to decide to go to Michigan. And I told her, I said, I think I can't come back. I think, you know, this isn't going to work for me. I need to go somewhere else or take some time and figure out what else that I could do with my life, because everyone else around me is succeeding at Michigan, but I am not. And, you know, now I look back as a grad student and I think, wow, that was really stupid. Now that I'm teaching first year students, I realize a lot of them are failing because I'm grading them. But, you know, as a first gen student, I didn't have that support from my parents to say, that's normal. And, you know, it's going to be hard your first semester and probably your second semester too. But eventually you lock in, you get a groove, and you go forward and you get what you need to do. So I'm really lucky that I had, you know, my high school teacher to kind of talk me off the ledge. Otherwise, you know, I don't know if I would have graduated from U of M. I think it could have been a very different story for me.
Way to go, by the way.
Yeah. And Jamie, what about you with the students you work with? Because it's one thing to get them to school, get them started, but getting them all the way through.
Yeah, so support is so key. And just thinking about like that first year and what we hear from our students, it's often about belonging and feeling like I fit in here. And what we know, what the research shows us, is that if you don't feel like you fit in, that's the number one reason that you'll leave college. And we have young people that are largely underrepresented in the university system, which are young people who've aged out of foster care that I'm primarily serving. They largely feel like they don't belong. Nobody in their family may have ever expected them to go to school. They may have shown up without any supplies. They may not know anybody who's ever been to college. And so there's a lot of feeling like, do I even belong here? Was this the right decision? And I think, you know, when you have someone that they can go to that's supportive, that is able to be a consistent person that understands that that's going to be the case and has some tools to help them support students through that, we see success. I think one of the largest issues that we're dealing with in Michigan, and there has been a shift a little bit, but it's still a significant issue, is that the dollars are given to students for financial reasons, so tuition, grants, things like that, which get students to school, but if there's not people to help support them through, then we're not seeing them persist. And there's lots of evidence that supports that, and we're the legislature here in Michigan is appropriating dollars for grant-type scholarships for these students, but there's less people on the ground at the schools that are actually able to be a point person so that people can, the students are able to receive support to make it through those first difficult years and the other difficult years that show up.
Yes. Uh-huh. And tell us your name, please, too.
I'm Adam, and I actually had a question about the rising, popularity of online institutions like Udacity or Lynda.com or, you know, Code Academy, things that can teach you these traits and skills you might need in a job, and they don't actually go through a university where it's like, okay, maybe I want to learn a little bit of HTML, and so I take a class on there. So the question was, how do you feel those might be impacting universities because their costs are relatively cheap in comparison? And then number two is, do you ever feel like those will get the accreditation or the respect from that the university degree might hold, to where it's like, oh, these are actually a established and well-known, reputable source to get an education. Because most of the classes I've taken are actually very, 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 you know, thorough and good, and they taught me more than maybe a lot of my college classes have taught me. But I just feel, how do you guys feel about that? That's, yeah.
John, I'll come to you for help. Did any of that show up in your conversations across the state?
No, it's far deeper than we're able to get in a 90-minute meeting, but it's not too deep for Bridge Magazine to be exploring. A couple things. I think the customers are going to help determine that. If customers can go to these more affordable options to get training, and then they come out of it and they get jobs, that's where, if I'm running a university, I'm going to be worried, because that's a whole new model, and that's what I'm talking about. I think we're going to see some of this spring up. I'm not here to support any particular kind of education model, but it reminds me of another model that Bridge Magazine is researching right now. It's a charter school. It's an online-only charter school. It's in Okemos, Michigan. It has students from every corner of Michigan, and we found this through data. I'm not in favor of this school. I really don't know a lot about it, but I'm learning about the students that are going there. They're from all over the place, and this school is advertising itself as producing students that are then going on to universities all across the country. They better be right, and they better be credible, or Bridge, among others, will be shouting from the mountaintops. But I think this is an example of how the whole education system is changing. Parents are looking at alternatives that they didn't look to before. And I think it is a ripe landscape entrepreneurially for a credible institution to come along and provide a pipeline straight into certain kinds of jobs and careers, because they can lap a bigger institution. I don't know how many are out there that are credible. I don't know. But I do know that if I'm in university management, that kind of stuff is keeping me awake at night.
Yes.
Hey, my name's Dave. And my question has to do with something that you've touched a little bit on so far, and it's public education in the high school level, and preparing kids ahead of time so that they are informed on current trends, market trends, and education trends, so that they have all those options available to them and they have that knowledge. Do we think high school level is doing enough to prepare kids in the curriculum, and what do we think they could do to make sure that students have all of those options ready for them to consider?
Mm-hmm. Jamie, I want to ask you, and then I'll come to you, Adam. When you start working with your students, do you find they're prepared for college and aware, it sounds like, of the opportunities that are available, but also academically prepared?
Vocationally
prepared.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes, not often. And the population that I work with statistically are highly likely to change schools. And so we see high numbers of school changes are affecting academic preparedness. There's also a significant issue with young people who are in the foster care system, it's my expertise, and the privacy and logistical gaps that exist to allow them to talk openly with educators, so that the schools can't actually identify the students that might need the help. And so they are not getting the resources. They're not aware unless they have a really great caseworker that knows of the resources that can help guide them before they graduate. And then all of a sudden we're scrambling to find out what you're going to do because you need transition services and you're first generation and we don't know if there's money, and you get shoved somewhere because somebody wants you to be there, which I alluded to earlier. So there's some progress in that area. There are some bills that are coming down that are going to allow the privacy, basically the child welfare system and the education system to talk to one another, which will help out, but it's going to take some time to blend those two systems together. They don't work well together.
Adam, what about you, about that preparation while you're in high school? You already said that academically it was difficult that first year, but it sounds, from a vocational standpoint, from a social standpoint, do you feel like you got that preparation?
I guess for me, not really. I mean, just when you think about the UP and you think about Ann Arbor, two very, very different places. In high school, I was, campaigning for Sarah Palin, and now I think a little bit differently about things. So, socially... socially, a lot of things in my life have really changed since high school. And at least for me in Menominee growing up, it was kind of everyone thought the same way. It was a very homogenous place. And, you know, I really appreciated getting to Ann Arbor so that I could see both sides of the story and choose which one was best for me. And, you know, I keep a lot of close ties with people, mainly teachers from my high school. And the way that they're doing things now, it really confuses me about and worries me about the future of, you know, the kids that Menominee High School sends out into the workforce, because their focus has completely shifted, and I think this might be a statewide thing. You'll probably know more about that than I do, John, but into just getting kids to graduate. You know, they've pumped a lot of extra money into these programs that help low-achieving kids graduate while they're cutting the classes that kids like me used to take to try and prepare ourselves for high school. So even in the sense of, you know, socially challenging ourselves, I think it's going to be a lot harder, at least for Menominee students in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years to be prepared for college than it even was for me.
Mm-hmm. Because there is this, I think it might have been on Bridge, talking about the gap that exists for some students when they start college, that they can end up taking like a year of remedial classes before they even get to core classwork.
Before I address it, Adam, if you truly do your civic duty, by the time you're in your 70s, you should be living in a gated community in Florida and once again advocating for Sarah Palin. It's a circle of life, man. One of our writers, Ron French at Bridge, writes a ton about education. And he recently did a story contrasting the career and college preparation resources between an Ann Arbor high school that Ann Arbor's dialed into this from birth on, and a high school in Lansing, which was more of a blue-collar high school. And he contrasted the life of two students and how very different their choice-making processes were. That's a huge part of this issue. If I can give some good news, there is an incredible and growing program in the state started by the Michigan College Access Network. Again, I'm not here to promote them. I'm not here to advocate them. But we've looked at what they do and how they do it, and they're really solving an incredible gap. They've placed dedicated college entrance counselors in about 100 high schools around the state that never had such a thing before. High school counselors are incredibly outnumbered. Depending on which number you use, it's either 500 to 1 or 700 to 1. 700 students for every counselor. Most of what they do has nothing to do with college or career counseling. They're doing third Friday counts, and they're doing social work a lot of the time. It's the state, the governor's education advisor talked about this yesterday, and she said, I would no more place college advising responsibility on high school counselors than I would the man on the moon. It's just, it's a fairy tale if you think high school counselors are going to suddenly solve this problem, even if there's more of them. But this program that Michigan College Access Network has launched, they're taking recent counseling graduates who've come out of counseling programs, they're certified. They then work with veteran high school counselors who don't have time to deal with this, and all they do is work on college access issues and career counseling. It's an incredible, you know, it's the kind of solution that comes out of times of adversity, and I just think it's heroic what they're doing. And I think that kind of creative thinking, and it's funded 6 different ways. There's some philanthropy involved. There's some government money involved. That's what it takes today. Every government dollar is spoken for 6 ways. This is a blend of resources that's created a new solution to a really tough problem. And I really encourage you to look it up. They're in their 3rd or 4th year now, and I just think they're doing fascinating work, and I think it's what it's going to take.
Yes, Brittany.
I'm Sarah. I'm also part of that group of students that just graduated and not pursuing another degree or going for graduate school. What kind of resources are out there for students who have fallen under that? There are no jobs, or we don't really know where to go, and we want to stay in state, but there's not really a place for us. And then also, how do we compare to other states in those kinds of resources?
John? Well, for starters, every Friday night there's the Powerball. No, in all seriousness, Google Michigan's Christmas Carol, which was a terrible headline. Bridge did 10-year job projections for all kinds of job categories, and we ran it at Christmas time, so we used this stupid headline, Michigan's Christmas Carol. It'll give you job projections for every field by region of the state. That's one thing. It's tough. What's your degree in? All right. My wife was a voice performance major, and she's an adjunct professor. My house is full of you. And I love you. You got to keep at it. I mean, you went into it for a reason, right? Don't give up your love. And it's never too late to start planning strategically about what you're going to do in the future. And this, like I said, there's a lot of people out there like this fella, Jim Danielski, that I talked about. He sees people like you every day. Economics majors, earth science majors, you name it. They're in his office developing life plans, and I think they're doing some pretty cool work. You just got to keep going.
Yes.
My name's Kathy. I'm working on a report right now about the College Advisor Corps, particularly at Comstock High School. It's a really great program. They're very excited about it, and it really helps these students to have someone who is focused solely on the college process for these seniors. My question is, why don't we just go ahead and fund having college advisors like that in every single high school in Michigan? I know they want to expand it to like 300 or something next year, but and also I know that it's focused on helping low-income students to access college, but I think every student needs it. I know for myself, when our oldest daughter was a senior, I'm a college graduate, K College, yay, so is my husband. He has a master's. He has a law degree from U of M. And my daughter's in her senior year, and we're like, I don't know what to do. What do we do about getting you ready to, like, apply to college and all that stuff? We ended up hiring somebody to help her get through the process, which is ridiculous. But her high school had just, there were just wasn't anything there, really, because the counselors were so busy doing other things.
Yeah. So is there talk about expanding it statewide? Or
it would cost about $40 million a year in taxpayer money to have one of these counselors dedicated to college issues in every high school. I don't know if that sounds like a lot or a little. The state spends well more than $10 billion a year on K-12 education. Every one of those dollars is spoken for and fought for violently all year long. Rearranging how $40 million gets spent is a huge undertaking. It may sound ridiculous, but it is. It's a huge undertaking. And Brandy Johnson, who runs the program, spoke yesterday. She's not sure it's needed everywhere. In some schools, in some of our wealthier enclaves, this is not an issue. But I think for maybe $10 million, we could fill a lot of gaps in the state. And I think their emerging success there, I think, will change the game. And I think in a few years, it doesn't help. It doesn't help you now, but in a few years, I think this will change. I think we will have a lot better discernment process available for students. We evolve over time, and this is a really good news story, I think.
I think some of it comes back to this issue of networks, and just to put in a quick plug for State of Opportunity, Jennifer Guerra, one of the reporting leads on the project, is working on a doc about networking, which you say, what? But it's about how, when you are brought up in a low-income community, having networks of people who can guide you through processes, like making a decision about college as opposed to a vocation, they aren't there. If you're a first-generation college student and nobody in your family talks about that as an option or the financial part of it or how to do that life plan, sometimes you just get stuck. Or you may go through college and come out on the other end and not have a network in place to help you figure out that employment path. So you said, for instance, you and your husband were able to find somebody. So you, even if you didn't know what to do yourselves, you knew who to find to figure it out. And some people don't have that in place at all.
Now than it was
then it, Yeah, Brittany.
Oh, hi, my name is Joe, and I'm a former Bronco. And my question when we talk about the rising cost of college is, how much do gen eds contribute to that, and do we need to change that structure at our universities? And for those who don't know, gen ed, your general education requirements. So when I went to school all bright-eyed and wanting my degree in finance, and I talked to a counselor, and they say, finance, that's great. First, let me tell you about holistic health, and you're going to pay hundreds of dollars to take a class in that. And then you're going to take a class in geology, and then you're going to take a class in this. And I get that part of that is being a well-rounded individual, but in the 11-ish years since I've graduated, more than I want to admit, and in a career in finance, I have never once relied on any information I picked up in European art history, yet I shelled out thousands of dollars for these classes.
I can one-up you. I took a Frisbee class my freshman year.
At least you're outside. That was fun.
Southern Methodist University. I was like, I got to transfer back to Michigan because this is ridiculous.
It's Joe, right? Is it Joe? Joe, then there's a professional finance certification program. What's it called? I've forgotten the name of it. You can go on. One's a financial analyst. You can get certified in a financial analyst, yeah. Right? There's not a single geology class in that, if I recall.
Not to my knowledge.
Yeah. I think it's a great point. Even more than just the gen ed, and I think part of the argument is, yeah, well-rounded individual, and we could probably have a whole debate about that too. But then there's the remedial work. Like you came to school and you were scared there and you had some trouble when you started out. Students are spending per year in Michigan $100 million, much of it student loan money, simply taking remedial classes because they're not yet proficient at the things that we expected them to get done in high school. Huge costs involved because we're just not there. And Karen McPhee, the governor's financial advisor, she really put this so well yesterday. She said, you know, for generations, we built this education model to produce people who could then go into manufacturing. And we just haven't completely changed the model yet. There's so much work going on in here, it's dizzying on how education is changing. But I think you got legitimate beefs. And back to our friend over here who talked about, hey, I'm taking classes over here on this online thing and I'm learning a lot. That's where, again, if I'm running a university, it's keeping me up at night because it's ripe for change in different models to get people to the pipeline that they want to get employed.
And Jamie, what does that do? I mean, when a student comes in and realizes that, you know, the first year of schooling for me is not going to be doing the work I want to do. It's going to be stuff I didn't learn in high school. How does that change the experience or maybe guide them away from a college education?
Has a lot of impacts. So when you learn that and you are already nervous about being here and you feel like you might not fit in, and then you hear, I have to take all these classes that don't even count for credit towards my degree and extend my time here out a year, extend the amount of money that I'm spending a year, it can be the tipping point for saying, never mind. You know, I don't want to be here anymore. The other thing that I think is really significant is the Pell Grant ends after 5 years. So we see programs sometimes that are 5 years in length. You add a year of remedial classes or seminar classes or transition classes into the freshman year. You've got 6 or 7 years at a university with a Pell Grant that lasts for 5 years. And so after the Pell Grant's out, the loans just kick up even more, and maybe even private loans because the public loans aren't going to cover all of the costs. So it's very significant. I think it's a really great point.
If I can just stick up, though, for gen ed for just a minute. I took a class my freshman year from a Jesuit priest at Western Michigan University, and I think it was in Noss Hall. It was Dr. Francis Gross. I'll never forget him. He taught me a tremendous amount, and it's the accidental serendipitous learning that you get, that you can get if you avail yourself to it, that does make you a well-rounded individual. And I certainly want my kid to get that too. And also just on campus, I mean, the things you learn that aren't even in the classroom. We could have another night just Resident Hall stories.
Things John learned in college.
Not in class.
Not in class.
Chad, did you get that?
Chad.
So, Chad, yep. So, I was just wondering what you think of the bachelor's degree being the new, like, high school diploma, round two. I went to school, got essentially an associate's in biology, worked in pharmaceuticals for 10 years, and then I was laid off from that industry, went back to school, obtained my college degree, my bachelor's. Now I'm working, making less than I was before in the same industry, and I found that I couldn't obtain a job without that degree, but I'm not reaping many rewards from that piece of paper.
Jamie, I think I want to come to you on this one because you know, like I said at the beginning, there's this promise. You go to college, which is a very loose, we're going to go to college and then come out and get a job. But it's not really that simple anymore. It's getting to a point where you have to have that secondary, that post-bachelor's degree to do what you want to do.
Yeah, many people are understanding that graduate school is a necessity for many professions to make it worthwhile. I can't ever discount the bachelor's degree, though. I mean, in the work that I do, what we know, the trajectory of students that don't earn a bachelor's degree is that they end up homeless, they end up unemployed, they end up incarcerated, they end up with unwanted or early pregnancies. And the bachelor's degree changes that trajectory. The associate's degree, I think, can do the same. A trade certificate can do the same. So I'm a huge proponent of find what you love, find a way that you can make money doing that, and if it's not a four-year degree, then wonderful, but some sort of post-secondary education really changes outcomes for especially first-generation, low-income, underrepresented students.
From the student side of it, though, Adam, when you're talking, well, you're a grad student now, but when you were in undergrad, what were those conversations? What were people talking about post-graduation? Was it like, I'm going to be able to get a job, or was it, guess I got another 4 years to go or 2 years to go?
It was not the former. It was definitely more of the latter. So, I mean, a lot of people went to grad school or a lot of people took jobs in unrelated fields just so that they could have some source of income while they figured out what they were going back to go to grad school for eventually. I know people always ask me, so I created my own major at U of M, which was interdisciplinary, looking at healthcare disparities, and people always ask me, you know, what would you have done if you didn't get into this master's program? And I always say, well, I could have easily found a job in research, but the truth is I don't know what I would have done if I wouldn't have gotten into this master's program. And even graduating now with my master's program, I see my colleagues who are looking for jobs right now as we are about to graduate, and they're scrambling almost as much as we were as undergrads looking for jobs. You know, with our U of M is number 4 in the country for the program that I'm in, and even people graduating from this school are having a hard time finding a job.
Hi, my name's Edward. I'm an EMU Eagle grad, so go Eagles. To counter what Joe was saying earlier about gen eds, it's kind of a question comment combo. For me personally, I think gen eds are extremely important because as humans, we aren't spending every hour of every day living what we're doing for work. We're spending time with other people, we're spending time voting and, you know, doing finances and learning about economics and, you know, things that matter when it comes to living life. Obviously the current trend is cutting all of the programs in elementary and middle school that used to be, I guess, what you would say gen eds, music, art, business, you know, you used to be taught how to run a checking account when you were in middle school. That doesn't really happen anymore. Is there anything that we're moving toward something like that again, now that there's all this backlash from teaching to the test, or is there a chance that we could move toward something that would maybe make gen eds more relevant or more popular to the general public?
John?
After the fight Michigan has had over the Common Core in the Capitol, I don't think there's a huge appetite to go back in and change overall requirements in a wholesale way anytime soon. This is a question of haves and have-nots. The haves are doing all kinds of things along those lines. There's Kumon, and there's six other after-school tutoring programs. A lot of that life experience is starting to get privatized for those who can afford it. The students that Jamie works with, that's a different picture altogether. And in our reporting at Bridge, we see that issue of haves and have-nots across the board in everything. And more than half the babies in Michigan are now born on Medicaid. We've got a lot of have-nots in this state. And the more we ignore that, the more we do so at our peril, because the haves can't take care of us all.
Well, and I think this ties in a bit to that question. You said earlier we had an educational system that was basically training factory workers. That was what we were preparing people to do. And those jobs aren't there anymore. Is our educational system, both at the, I would say, the K-12 level and the collegiate level, training people or preparing them for the employment opportunities that are available in Michigan now? Are those things matching up?
The public says no. In our survey research, a whole lot of people describe career navigation, high school counseling, toward career navigation as terrible or lousy. And there are great teachers everywhere, and there are teachers that maybe aren't so great in a lot of places too. The great ones are making their work relevant to the real world every day, and that's super hard to track who's doing that and who isn't. But when we see that level of remediation and the cost of that, and we see so many students after their bachelor's still wondering, what the heck am I going to do now? The system isn't responding. But I don't think there's a cavalry coming to the rescue on this. I think for the haves, I think families are going to be strategizing at a much earlier age. And for the have-nots, I think the path is that much steeper.
Yes, Brittany.
Hi, my name is Nathan. I graduated recently from WMU with biology bachelor's, and I just started my master's. I was sort of thinking about an intersection between the whole haves and have-nots being prepared for college and the just financial burden of college. And what do you think about the fact that it's extremely economically punishing for anyone who doesn't go into college with what they finish in college? If you switch majors and you extend your college stay for a year, 2 years, maybe 3 years, you run out of cheap loans, grants, et cetera, and you end up with a much larger loan burden for your degree level.
And Jamie, you alluded to that, even with the remedial year you may need to take of classes, but even if you just, this is supposed to be a time of exploration, a time for you to kind of figure out who you're going to be in the world, but you got to do it in 4 to 5 years, So, how does that work with your students?
It's a challenge. It's a challenge. Even the scholarship program that Western offers has a 5-year limit on it. So if a student does decide to change a major halfway through and extend their time there longer, there's a lot of hoops to jump through even to get some of the services that are present. So, yeah, it's a significant issue. I think some of the good news is a lot of the gen eds will transcend different majors, but not all of them will. So if you go from a nursing major to a theater major, you're essentially starting over. There's not always a way to leverage your current classes against new majors.
Mm-hmm. And is that a calculation as a student that you make or that you find other students making, like, oh, I'm really not enjoying this. I'm not having a good time in, engineering or biology, whatever it may be. But it's too expensive for me to switch tracks at this point.
Yeah, I think I've seen it both ways. I've seen more people switch than not switch, I would have to say. But again, in the U of M crowd, people usually have the resources that being able to switch is not a huge deal. And I guess speaking from it personally, I'm kind of an anomaly because I switched from left to right to up and down and still managed to start grad school as a senior. So, I can say that it can be done, but I also, had to work really hard to be able to do that, switching back and forth, but also, of course, calculating what is going to count if I were to make this switch and what wouldn't count and how far would that put behind me, how far behind would that put me, and how many summer classes am I going to have to take to make that up, and that's what I ended up doing.
Mm-hmm. John?
If you wait for policy solutions on some of these things, you suffocate turning blue in the face. It takes a long time. There are some good developments. I think the business community is pressing, and I think campuses around the state are also awakening to the need to be more efficient and student-friendly, customer-friendly, whatever you want to call it, in some of these regards. There's a lot of work going on right now on transfer credits and making campus requirements more conversant across campuses because a lot of students are switching all the time. This guy, Jim Danielski, I keep talking about, he sees people like this all the time who they get to a certain point and they have to stop and say, what the heck am I trying to do with my life? Because this is getting super expensive more and more. At the same time, we're talking about teenagers and people in their early 20s coming into a campus environment, and if you're the most together, intellectual, on your feet, responsible person, it's this carnival. Look at all the opportunities and the things I can learn. I mean, that's a drug in itself. Who doesn't want to sample that? And can we nice, responsible, older adults say, hey, kids, get it together. Remember the guy in The Graduate who said to Dustin Hoffman, go into plastics, you know? Mm-hmm. That kind of thing is still as square today as it was when that movie came out. It's tough.
But it feels like we're moving in that direction with this increased focus on STEM. And, I mean, gosh, if I was in high school now, I was a theater major. I was a performing arts major in high school. I went to a magnet school, and that was, you know, what I expected to do with my life. But there were avenues for that. There were avenues for me to still explore that, and it's not that way anymore. That carnival atmosphere, I think, has really shifted. We're just getting to the end of our time, so let's take a couple more questions.
Hey, yeah, my name's Brenton. I went to a four-year university, and about 2 years through, I started realizing that the thing that I was being taught in class was really not going to be worth anything to me in the real-world environment. So what I'm wondering is if there's any kind of level for checks and balances to make sure that what we're learning in school is applicable to a job market, because 90% of the guys that I graduated with are still unemployed, and I'm wondering if, is that all on the university, or is there something from within the government that actually can do some kind of checking in that regard?
So this gets back to that question I asked earlier about whether or not we're preparing students for the job market that exists in Michigan specifically, but more broadly. I mean, I think the goal is to keep as many people here, right? To keep as much of that education in the state, but does our educational system support that?
There's, to my knowledge, there's no government watchdog looking over whether what's getting taught in classes is actually happening in the real world. But part of what you learn in college is inquiry and to investigate. And I think there's a lot of opportunity on individuals to investigate the fields that they want to look into. There's never been more information available to any of us than there is today. And there are a lot of employers out there. They might not hire you today, but if you go bang on the door and you want to learn more about the field and you want to shadow, you can do that. And you can ask them, what do I need to do to become relevant to you? And I think increasingly, as employers are having a challenging time finding exactly the talent they're looking for, employers are open to that question. And maybe it's not always the right approach to ask your professor, am I doing the right things? Or maybe it's trust and verify. Get out there and do your own research and understand what your field's about. There's so much information out there today, but it's a heck of an effort to sift through. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, good evening. My name's Raymond. Quick comment on the Gen Ed. There is a middle ground there, and at the university level and other levels, we're doing a better job of educating employers on certain Gen Eds, particularly those that would help with critical thinking, analysis, problem solving, the benefit of those, particularly paired with a technical degree. But I also want to ask, we're seeing a lot of upswing now in the early middle college aspect. It's been around in Michigan since 92. Doesn't seem to have a lot of traction until the last year or two. But that's one, again, at Western, where I'm employed, we're working with a number of entities to try and how does a student able to come to me or to a community college or somebody already with 1 or 2 years, even perhaps an associate degree, after that 13th year of high school.
I think that's a great point. We're seeing that at the statewide policy level, too. A lot more conversations between high schools, community colleges, and universities about smoothing that pathway. Students are going to make jumps. They're going to jump around. And how do we help them hang on to those credits they pick up along the way? And there's a tremendous amount tremendous number of high school students in the state that are picking up college credits early.
And we're seeing a focus from the federal level, too.
And that's college. Driven by costs. Mm-hmm. I truly believe that. It's driven by families trying to make this more affordable for themselves.
Mm-hmm. I think we have time for one more question.
Hi, I'm Matt Ross, professor of finance at Western Michigan. I'm wearing the suit because I came directly from class teaching my students about the cost of college. I'd like to flip it around and talk about the benefits. So we talked a lot about debt to open this thing up. I graduated from University of Michigan with a couple of our panel members. That debt was the best I had. That's the best debt I've ever had in my life. Because that set me up for a lot of opportunities. It gave me the skills that I needed to go out. The benefits of an education are phenomenal. And to take a little debt along the way to invest in that human capital, that is well worth it. Because those benefits accrue to the individual. Comments?
Comments.
I think the ROI is different for every individual in every program. I think certainly in finance, there's a lot of ROI out there. Our friend here in theater, maybe her ROI is a little different. I don't think it's a universal statement that you can make that guaranteed, if I take on this debt, boy, I'm going to prosper later.
Yeah. I also just want to mention there are some, especially for the students that I work with, there's a lot of anxiety and fear about what that debt's going to mean after graduation when I don't have maybe a home. We know like 90% of students that graduate with a bachelor's degree go home for a period of time versus getting their first place. And when you don't have a home to go back to, you're now facing my student loan payments coming due along with trying to get an apartment and a car, and I may not find a job in 6 months. So there's a lot of fear and anxiety to even taking on that debt because what it's going to mean if I can't pay it off for me because I don't have any other support to help me bridge that gap after school. Do I believe that the bachelor's degree, that the degrees are worth it? Absolutely. And that's why I do the work that I do. But there's a lot of factors that play into the amount of debt that you get and what that means right after graduation.
So just to wrap up, you know, just I want your final thoughts if you had the folks who make the decisions in the room. What would you want them to know about the affordability question, the access question, specifically from your perspective, working with students, as a student, as a journalist? I'll start with you, Jamie.
So my parting thought is that we need to support students once they get to school, and we need to support them in the soft skill areas, the professional development areas, while they're getting the academic development through their classes.
There's a lot of folks who make decisions. I'm going to focus my answer on the individual and the families. If you're part of the haves, strategic thinking and planning and discernment in your family can't start early enough. It doesn't mean you're not going to change majors 7 times like I did and flunk out your first day of student teaching like I did, but you can't start asking yourselves those questions soon enough, and you cannot believe in blind faith that if I just go, it's going to be wonderful. And if you're in the have-nots, do your best to take advantage of the information that's out there and seek out mentors and leaders like these new counselors that are part of the Michigan College Access Network. Believe that you can make it, and you can. Just keep climbing.
Adam, you get the last word.
Awesome. So, I mean, agree with what both of you have to say. I would say, from my perspective, as a student, I would say to talk to people like me more than what's currently happening. You know, this is the first time I've been asked to talk about these issues in all of my time since I've been in school. Which I think is great, and I'm glad that's happening. But, you know, I always wonder what more could be happening to help people like me if people knew the problems that we were facing. You know, the soft skills, the academic skills, but also the social issues that low-income and first-gen students face in college. Because for me, those were some of the things that hindered me almost more so than some of the academic skills. And being able to help students locate the resources that are available. Because now that I look back, I realize how many resources were available to me that I never knew about until, honestly, it was too late after I graduated for the most part.
Well, just a couple of quick mentions. We have a documentary coming up again on networking as part of State of Opportunity. The next State of Opportunity show is coming up on the 22nd?
Yes.
On the 22nd, it's going to be focused on life after high school, some of the different options people choose to build a life for themselves, whether it be a four-year university or community college or entering the military or using something like Job Corps to actually build a foundation for their lives. So you can look forward to that and just keep an eye on michiganradio.org or listen, of course, and you'll be able to hear those shows coming up. Thank you so much to Jamie, John, and Adam for being on our panel. Thank you for your great questions tonight. And we hope to see you at another Issues and Ale. Again, thanks to One Well Brewing for opening their house to us.
Thank you.
And we hope to see you again real soon. Take care, everybody. Drive safely.